This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup.
You know, it's still an amazing honor when Beyoncé warned me. I didn't know she was going to select my designs, and it was for the Global Citizen Festival. And then I was watching it online, and she was already in the middle of her performance wearing my dress, and I started shaking and taking a video of my screen, and I was shocked that that's the response it ignited in me, but it did.
Hello and welcome to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. In this series of podcasts from Harrods, I'm talking to people at the top of the creative arts and industries. Today, my guest is Mary Katranzu, who in 10 short years has taken the fashion world by storm. She's been called the Queen of Prints and delights in combining very disparate elements, not usually associated with high fashion, to create visually stunning clothes for women. Her last collection included a transparent blow-up jacket packed with imitation coral and seaweed over a white tulle dress covered in embroidered flowers. This is luxury with a breathtaking twist. So I thought maybe we could start with the fact that you are renowned for the incredible colour and the incredible designs and the incredible textiles that you create. But you're sitting here opposite me like an old Greek widow. and you're not old.
No,
you are
and
Greek,
I'm not a widow.
You're not a widow. So how is it that how you dress is in such direct contrast to what you design?
I've been asked that a lot.
That doesn't
Not
surprise me.
Not calling you unoriginal, but it's allowed me the time to actually reach deep within and figure out why am I in black, because it happened as a gradual process. But I think the reason is exactly because of my work. I think it started kind of becoming a uniform where it's kind of permeated other areas in my life where you make so many decisions at work to do with color and texture and anyway, decisions that you don't want to make any other decision. So now when I sit at a restaurant, my friends order, I don't want to make that decision. I don't want to. It becomes not only a uniform, but it also becomes a palate cleanser. My entire team through the years, they come super colorful into the interviews. And then a year in, everyone is in black. So I think it's something that's like subconsciously happens because you're around so much pattern of color. So many decisions in your daily work life have to do with color that it's a way to kind of
Step back,
yeah.
So if you're not designing for you,
yes,
who are you designing for?
Well, I am designing for me in a way because I think that my personality and the personality of women that are attracted to my work are very similar, even though I dress in black and they dress in color. I am quite daring and bold, and I am a positive person, and there's something very exuberant in the clothes that kind of, I guess, is a part of the women who actually come into the Mary Katranzu world and buy into it. So my women are confident women. They want to stand out. They want to feel they're wearing something artistic and unique. And in that way, I'm drawn to all those things. I just think through actually designing them, I don't celebrate them on me. Having said that, when I'm on holiday, I'm not in black. I actually am in like fluoro. So I think it's kind of also a way to divide that. Now I feel too self-conscious to go to work in anything but black because it will just like cause an uproar. Uproar in the studio. What is going on?
I love the idea that I'm talking to the first person I've ever met who's OD'd on color.
Yeah, I've OD'd on color.
You've been described as a quirky maximalist.
Yes. I don't think I am a maximalist. I think the way we design our textiles and the surface manipulation veers into maximalism, but I think the silhouettes are more purist in form. And I think it's always been about the balance of both. So I think the silhouettes are usually, especially the commercial range that, you know, is what women wear and what you'd find at Harrods, it's actually a very pragmatic wardrobe. And then the show is all about really pushing the vision and being as creative as you can with whatever theme each season has.
It feels like you really are in your own field when it comes to the shows and things. I mean, the designs are incredibly sculptural. I mean, it is like it's performance art. It's got so many different strands to it. You know, I think the sort of 3D dimensional nature of the designs and everything feels like you've been influenced by so many different things. What would you describe as the chief influences to your work?
first of all, I didn't study fashion. So I think my inspiration never comes from a particular era or a particular silhouette. And I think most designers start in that way, were feeling 70s or 40s. So usually people can't place my collections in terms of an era because the artwork defines the silhouette. So, you know, in collections where we've done a collection on Pangaea and Panthalassa, you know, the tectonic plates became the form of the dress. So you can't really place that in a certain time. And I think that's the more unique side of my work because I'm quite inquisitive and the way I work is kind of picking one thing, one theme and delving really deep into it. It's about finding all the different layers. So, and the most successful collections I've done is when it all comes together. Sometimes it comes together, sometimes it doesn't.
But in many ways then you are like the most unlikely clothes designer, you know, because so much of what you do feels like a sort of an intellectual exercise rather than a dressing exercise.
Yeah, I mean, we have to usually discipline ourselves and think, you know, a woman is not a concept. I always say that when we go too far, okay, a woman is not a concept. A woman needs to wear this. This needs to feel desirable and it needs, but that comes in the way we execute because especially on the print side, I think the desirability of a print, especially when it's as bold as most of our prints are, is about how flattering it feels. That's why for a woman who's never bought my work, it changes completely when she tries it on and she sees that it's extremely flattering on her body. Because sometimes, you know, women who don't wear print will be a bit hesitant. So we always try to encourage that they try it on. It's not on a hanger. It's supposed to work on your body. The conceptual side of it gets explored in the show. And then on the real ready-to-wear, wearable clothes that get produced, and that's really not the majority of our shows, all the work goes into it being very flattering, into the silhouettes being very freeing. And the structure that you see in the show is usually not something that's translated directly into stores.
So which
sometimes some pieces, but not all.
So which interests you the most, the conceptual side of it?
Both.
Or creating things that actually give people a silhouette that they probably didn't even know they could achieve?
Both. I think because I didn't start in fashion, there's something in me that still wants to challenge myself creatively, but my starting point and my end point is quite different. You know, the statement pieces that we do in a show, it's something that becomes somebody's collection. And I'm so lucky that I have women that honestly, if I ever wanted to do an exhibition, they have so many of those pieces that they could literally host an exhibition of my work. And that's a beautiful feeling to know that they exist in the world and you're not doing them in vain. But equally, I'm very happy when a woman buys a dress or a blouse or a coat from us that she'll wear over and over again without having to think twice.
So tell me a bit, you've said a couple of times, you know, that you didn't start out as a designer. So Tell me a little bit about how you got to this place. So you started out really, I mean, initially, I think, interested in architecture and interior design and so on. And then that moved on to textiles?
It moved actually naturally. And I went to RISD in the US to study architecture initially. And my mother is an interior architect, interior designer. So that felt natural. And also growing up in Greece, fashion wasn't really an industry that you grew up looking up to. I always thought I would go back to Greece and I was always trying to find a discipline or something that would allow me to be creative, but actually would also allow me to go back to Greece and work there. So that's why I started studying architecture. Then I met my now fiancé and he was doing his MSc in London, who was going to come. And RISD and St. Martin's had an exchange program where you could take 3 months abroad and come and you could choose from something that would allow me to be creative, but actually would also allow me to go back to Greece and work there. So that's why I started studying architecture. Then I met my now fiancé and he was doing his MSc in London, who was going to come. And RISD and St. Martin's had an exchange program where you could take 3 months abroad and come and you could choose from a few different courses. And one of them was textile design. And I was always interested. There was a side of my work that was incredibly detailed and I was strong in color. So I thought, you know, that could be so interesting if I go into interiors, you know, it will be a valid course to take. So I took that course, came to London. My boyfriend didn't come to London for about 2 years. By that time, I'd already fallen in love with London and the independence that it allowed you to have. The educational system was so different. At first, I was a bit nervous in that, you know, you could go in whenever you wanted, you could define your own projects. It was very different. And then learn to appreciate the freedom and how it allowed you to channel your own creativity and figure out things on your own. So I decided to stay.
So you had total freedom for 2 years. You had freedom at college.
Total freedom.
And no boyfriend.
Yes, yes. So I fell in love with London. That alone was a shift, and I felt much more creatively inspired here as an environment. So I applied to finish my BA here and swapped courses to textile design. But I was still doing textile for interiors. And I just thought, why don't I do my last project on fashion and explore it? Honestly, it was terrible. The project was terrible. But it allowed me for the first time to look at photorealism and how you can... I was draping a lot and translating that into print. And then I applied to the RCA and St. Martin's. RCA was for textiles for interiors. St. Martin's was for fashion print. And when I got accepted in both, there was something drawing me into St. Martin's because I'd heard so much about Louise Wilson and how it
Who's
really
the tutor
is boot
at the
camps.
Time.
Yeah, she was the course director, and she was, you know, notoriously difficult, but also I think an incredible mentor to so many designers who came out of it. So I just felt, because it was different, I felt if I ever wanted to go back to doing print for interiors, I could fall back into doing that.
I'm interested in you saying that, you know, even now, kind of justifying it with, I knew I could go back to interiors and that wasn't, you know, is that because your father was so keen for you not to become a clothes designer?
But I don't think he was that keen of me becoming an interior designer either, to be honest. He actually never really minded fashion. What he did minded, St. Martin's, when I transferred into it, was not yet part of University of the Arts. It was just St. Martin's College. So he was very disappointed that I wasn't going to get a university diploma, to the point that he wrote my mother a handwritten letter saying, you are the reason that our daughter will be a failure. Like, literally. She still has the letter.
I bet.
Because he's old school. And, you know, for him, I'm also an only child. So I just think he wanted a university degree. And in 2005, which is when I graduated from St. Martin's, that's when they merged. So I was the first year to actually get a university degree. So it all worked out. He was very proud in the end. It's all good.
And he got to witness the success that you attracted from the very, very first MA show that you did.
Yeah, I mean, now they're really proud. But like, when he's faced with that from my mother, he just like says, but who would ever thought she was talented? So I was like, well, somebody believed in my talent. So he just didn't, he thought I was doing it for the wrong reasons, but it wasn't really the case. I think timing of me meeting Marius at that time was key.
Marius is your fiance.
Marius is my fiance.
Don't worry, it's your lovely ring. She's just taken off a very large and beautiful,
oh God,
glittering diamond ring.
I just got engaged, that's why it's like...
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I know you've been waiting for him to pop the question for a while.
Yes, that is correct. 16 years.
Really?
It's about time, yes.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Will it be another 16 years before you get married?
Probably. It's going to be the longest engagement in the history of mankind.
And at what point did you realise that you had a creative talent that you could explore? I mean, did it take till your MA show and the sort of accolades you got then, or were you already determined that...
I was shy. I was an interesting combination because I didn't have self-confidence and self-belief, yet I was very ambitious with things I wanted to achieve. So it was a very conflicting mix. I always expected from myself the best, and yet I really felt I was at the bottom of the class, that everyone is better than me. I have no talent compared to all my classmates. So it was very interesting, and I don't know, but Louise really helped me, I think, find confidence in those 2 years, because she really kind of distilled in me that if you don't stand behind your work, nobody will, and that you need to have the research and understanding of what came before to kind of create newness. And
but it's quite scary. It must be really scary to sort of step out there doing something that is so original.
I was quite fearless in that way, because I thought that it's not that original. I just thought it's, you know, going back there, you need to understand that I went into my MA not knowing about fashion history at all. I remember spending the summer before I entered the MA reading up designs and doing like family trees of what came to what, like as if I'm going into, I don't know, fashion history instead of print MA. So I did not know, and I was endlessly inspired by discovering, you know, what's happened in fashion. I really didn't have that background. So I think because of that, I didn't see if something has or has not happened before. I think when I was doing the Trompe L'Oeil Prince...
That's your very first
That was my
collection.
Very first collection. Louise pinpointed that I've never seen anything like that. I've seen Trompe L'Oeil, but the way you do it is very different. And I thought, oh, you know, she's never said something positive about my work in a year. That must be something. So that meant something, but it didn't necessarily mean whether it's unique enough to have your own brand. I always felt I'm not a man. I'm not British. I've never studied fashion. There's so many things working against me. So I always felt I don't necessarily fit in. So because of that, I didn't have the confidence, but also I was lucky enough to get support from the beginning. So whenever I felt not confident enough, something always came along.
Is that why the British Fashion Council have been so important to you?
No, I was so lucky with timing because the British Fashion Council, especially when I started doing the showroom in Paris, so you could sell with them, you didn't need to sign with an agent. And that also gives you a different perspective, understanding of your work when you're selling your work yourself, because it gives you a direct relationship with the buyers. And I think that's critical. And they would tell you what stores you need to be in and what stores pay, what stores don't pay. They used to do press trips with us as a collective, and a lot of department stores could buy us as a collective.
I love the idea as well that, you know, people think of the fashion industry as being quite a bitchy one.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, as you describe it, you know, you're traveling as a group of designers. Yeah. You're like a support group in a way.
A lot of journalists making a distinction, in particular for London, that there's a camaraderie between us designers in London that maybe doesn't exist. So I don't know if it's a fashion phenomenon, but I do know that the British Fashion Council and, you know, and Sarah Moir and Orsini and Caroline Rush and everyone who was involved at that time created that.
What does luxury mean to you? I mean, it sounds like you have an incredibly busy life that you're really passionate about, mm-hmm. about what you do. So what for you, you know, sums up luxury?
I think luxury as in luxury in life, and then maybe also luxury in fashion, but luxury in life for me now is to have the time to appreciate everything that you do. And especially as women, I feel it's a good time in a way, but equally, it's a time that even more is expected from us. Also, you feel, okay, and I need to be this and I need to do that. And I think the luxury is to be able to know yourself well enough to say no, do the things that you really appreciate and have the time to appreciate the process. Because I look back now and I wish I spent more time appreciating or thinking, you know, I never allowed myself to have those moments of stillness. So I think that's luxury in a way. So the time to appreciate. And I think luxury in fashion, I think because fashion is kind of called upon to stand up for more. Men and women want to buy into luxury fashion, knowing that it's kind of guilt-free at the same time. And I think we're far away from that. But I think everyone is consciously aware of wanting to make sure that through what they create, first of all, you're not damaging the environment, but also that you're standing up for more than a pretty dress. And so I think that is the new luxury in fashion. I think that's where the world is shifting and how you want to buy into luxury. Of course, the craftsmanship, of course, you know, knowing how it's made and keeping some of those skills throughout because they are unique. And I think there's also a shift back into supporting craft. That is a very different space in fashion than even just 10 years ago.
Talk to me about the various influences in terms of your prints and things. I mean, you've incorporated everything from like Chinese porcelain, vintage stamps, Fabergé eggs, heraldic motifs, stamps, banknotes. You know, I mean, it seems so kind of myriad that it's hard to understand where the influences come from.
It's so interesting because you discover layers and you kind of unpeel different elements in your work, but you can only look back at that after, you know, a few collections have passed. So for our 10-year anniversary last year, we had a solo exhibition at the Dallas Contemporary Museum. And so you started seeing what connects your work. And it's true, especially at the beginning, there was a fascination with objects and how you can create print through a fascination of objects d'art to very mundane, everyday objects that you then elevate. I've looked at collectibles for a very long time, and there's a nostalgia that comes with that, because looking at postage stamps or obsolete banknotes or objects of art or jewelry or I don't even remember what else we featured, perfume bottles, they're all things we collect. And then on the flip side, our last collection, I thought, okay, a lot of my work has been more abstract about symbolism or about different ideas, you know, Bauhaus versus, you know, arts and crafts, or different ideas that are not tangible in the same way. So we wanted to do something intangible, and we focused on the four elements. So earth, fire, air, and water. It's connected to ideas and emotions and feelings. And I think we all have all those elements around us and within us. So that was kind of, I think, a 10-year anniversary on both sides of America Trans, one that has to do with emotion and the intangible, and one that has to do with the tangible around us and the beauty that's found in design and in art and in anything you want to collect because of its aesthetics.
You've made London your home, and you're clearly, you know, very much seen as a British designer.
Yeah.
I wondered how important to you the sort of Greek element of yourself.
It is so funny. It wasn't important at all, and now it suddenly is very important.
Well, because of Brexit.
Yeah, maybe. No. I think when I started, I never saw myself as I'm a Greek designer living here. And I think there's some things that you are brought up around that are innate in your aesthetics. I opened up more by me being in London. You know, what I consider beautiful growing up in Greece really changed when I was here, because you open up to such a mix of influences that when you're in Greece, you've never been around. So,
like what sort of thing?
Everything, you know, what beauty is, or what a woman wears, or how she styles, or, you know, Greek women's style is very different to British women's style. Like a Greek woman, especially when I was growing up, it was like pink lipstick, pink nail, pink bag, pink. I mean, I don't want to stereotype Greek women, but it's an element of coordination and finesse that they consider needs to be put. And a British woman is so much about feeling free to mix and match. And I wasn't coordinated, but I was very conditioned to precision. And your taste changes, your taste of what you considered beautiful changes. So all that changed. So I consider myself and my aesthetics heavily morphed and formed from my time in the UK, because this was my creative time. My creative formation was really my time here. But there's some ideas that are innate in me as a Greek, you know, my sense of color, which I think is a Mediterranean thing to a certain extent, my sense of symmetry and balance coming from architecture. There's certain things that, again, are instilled in your brain in the way you see things, or in the way you want to find harmony, that I think does come from my Greek upbringing. But I don't think my work has, I don't know, visible Greek origin, apart from that collection that we did on Greece. but now I felt the need to explore Greece more, spend time in Greece more, because I kind of left at 19, and the time I spend in Greece yearly is very, very limited.
So, in fact, that's interesting you would say that, because I was thinking very much about the sort of luxury that I always think of a Greek lifestyle, you know, and I know that I don't have to live there and work there, and, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time in Athens, but, you know, for me, you know, you think about a Greek island and, yeah, and the simplicity of the food, but yes, the sheer deliciousness of, yeah, it, and the eternal summers, you know, that the one place left on earth, I think, where you can still go and know that in August it's going to be sunny.
Yeah. I don't know for how long. I think everything is upside down. No, I honestly don't know for how long. But yeah, there's something about the simplicity of being brought up in Greece. And even when you go back, that you default back to age 19. And there's an innocence in that, that you haven't really experienced working life in Greece. So there's something very pure about that, that you've only seen Greece as your formative kind of young and teenage years.
Has it become your relaxing place now?
It is. It is, I mean, when I go there.
I think your mother said that you went for Christmas and didn't come out of your room more than twice.
Who did you say that to? The world.
The world, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
That's why,
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, I don't know what Christmas that is, but that's not far too far from the truth, because we spend a lot of time there just with friends, and you want to do nothing. I honestly, when I'm back in Greece, I don't want to do a thing. I receive no emails in the morning, and after like the first shock of the first 2-3 days, then you kind of ease in into stillness. And you don't get to do that in summer. It's only Christmas. So I think that's probably the why.
You're clearly a very energetic, powerful person in your own right. And I wondered if you think that that sort of translates itself to the sort of people who then choose to wear your clothes. You know, you've attracted people like Michelle Obama, Lady Gaga, the sadly late Zaha Hadid,
yeah.
Beyonce. Does it matter to you who wears?
Yes, it matters a lot. And I was saying that to one of my clients a few days ago, Sophia. We went to dinner and I was saying, I am so honored and privileged when I meet the women, and I've not met a woman that I don't respect and love. She's like, oh, you just attract amazing women because that's your work and that's who you are. And I say, in all my 10 years, you know, I'm not just saying that. I've met incredible women, and they're all positive, generous, confident women who've achieved a lot in their own right and want to support others. Positive and very inspiring women. and so that's very flattering.
And then there's Melania Trump.
And then there's Melania Trump, who I don't know, maybe as a human being, she is very generous. I don't know her personally. But I've had the privilege to meet a lot of the women I've dressed. Actually, a lot of the ones you mentioned I haven't, but Michelle Obama I did meet, for example. And I think there's something about the spirit of woman you've dressed. And when you get to know them and you understand who you are, you feel it makes it very real. You start designing with these women in mind. And it's not necessarily the women you mentioned. I don't like wake up thinking, Michelle, Beyonce, what would they want from this collection?
There is a great greetings card that says, what would Beyonce do?
Yeah, that's exactly it. What would Beyonce wear? But, you know, it's still an amazing honor when Beyonce wore me, because that's probably the most recent one. I didn't know she was going to select my designs, and it was for the Global Citizen Festival, and the dress we made for her was depicting the 54 countries of Africa. So it was something very personal. And the stylist, Jenke, who actually had commissioned me to do the piece, whenever I was texting him, he was like, oh, it's in God's hands now. And I was like, but did it fit? He's like, oh, I don't know. Only time will tell. Only God will tell. And I was like, why is God telling us? Isn't it a definite that she's going to wear it? Because I thought, you know, we've made it. She's going to wear it. But there were so many designers that had designed for that. So I thought he was letting me down softly. And so I didn't expect her to wear. And then I was watching it online and I was doing some work and I kind of looked left for a bit. I hadn't seen, and I looked right and she was already in the middle of her performance wearing my dress. And I started shaking and taking a video of my screen. And I was shocked that that's the response it ignited in me, but it did. There's definitely a set of values in the women who wear my clothes. And I think positivity and inclusivity and how open they are. It's not for an introvert. It's for somebody who actually is an extrovert and is very open about loving life and loving people around them.
It's definitely not for an introvert. I mean, let's talk about your perhaps 2018 collection, you know, a transparent blow-up jacket packed with imitation coral and seaweed, over a white tulle dress, smothered in embroidered flowers, a pair of dresses called Harry and Winston, with their frontage laid out as if they were sort of jewellery trays. Where do the ideas keep flowing from?
That was the anniversary collection. And so...
Is that an excuse?
That was the perfect excuse for us to go wild, to not feel restrained, clearly. So Harry and Winston were kind of a 3D reincarnation of the jewelry boxes we did at the beginning of my career as Prince, but we wanted to make them in 3D. And even, you know, the blow-up jackets, it was the idea of, you know, collecting all these precious items in almost as if it's in your own aquarium that you enclose yourself. So that collection, we actually didn't take it to market at all.
What's your luxury item? What's the thing?
This feels now so mundane. So the luxury item is a lint roller.
For a woman who wears black a lot, it's very important.
Yes, all those colored threads that you need to lint roll off. But also, it goes back to the luxury of time. It goes back to the luxury of time because you are at the studio all day long working on a collection, usually kind of covered in thread. And you do want to come to do this podcast, and you do need a lint roller. And that's a luxury to have that.
And just finally, you know, you're incredibly young and you've already had your work exhibited at the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art. You know, what keeps challenging you? What keeps you going? What do you want? What do you want,
what
Mary?
What do I want? I'd love to be able to do what I love, and I have that still. I feel incredibly lucky to be waking up and really enjoying what I do and really being able to do it in my own terms. So I'd love to grow the brand in a very authentic way. If I could maintain that, I'd be very happy.
And just finally, we're here in Harrods.
Yes.
If I let you loose, anywhere you want to go, anything you want.
Oh, God, well, there's everything. If you let me loose, I'll never leave. I'll be like loose, like bouncing off floors. And I'd love to go to the home floor because we're renovating our house. So that would be number one. Stop by the beauty, then go to the food hall. Meet some friends and then probably go back to work.
Okay, so we're talking about pretty much a whole day spent.
Yeah, we're talking
here,
about at least have a day, but I mean, but yeah, home. It's an incredible floor, and I actually started when we started the renovation. I went there 3 years ago. We're just moving in. We're just about to move in, so it's a good time to go back.
Slow move is at your house, as you've said already.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank
indeed.
You so much.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Mary Catranzo. This podcast was recorded in Harrods in London.